Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Wow. Sunshine and a modicum of warmth. That is this California thing. But there's this low hum. Can you hear it? In the Le Show Dome. I hear it. Maybe it's just I've been away too long. Anyway, yes. Sunshine. What is that thing? What is that yellow thing? And now, ladies and gentlemen, this just in. General Ray Odierno. Not Odorono, Odierno, the senior American commander in Iraq, said this week, this very week, that two influential Iraqi politicians have close links to Iran. Guess who one of them is? Ahmed Chalabi. He just figured this out. Ray, you've been there how long? 8 years? Never too late, department. General Odierno was especially blunt in publicly expressing concerns about the action of the two, Ahmed Chalabi, who was a confidant of Bush administration's officials in the prelude to the war, but is now perceived as having supplied false intelligence to the United States. Although you wouldn't know that from having seen Colin Powell on Face the Nation this morning. A distinguished general, isn't he? Wacky. Interpolation here. Tiger Woods lies about some private affairs, has to go and make a contrite, humbling public apology. Colin Powell lies about WMD in front of the United Nations, gets to go on talk shows and become, you know, resume his career as distinguished statesman. Anyway, back to General Odierno, the other Iraqi politician he says is connected to Iran is Ali Faisal Alami. They clearly are influenced by Iran, General Odierno says. We have direct intelligence that tells us that. Says the two men had several meetings in Iran, including sessions with an Iranian who was on the U.S. terrorist watch list. More about the new Iraq later in this broadcast. But about Iran, you've seen and heard multiple discussions this week of the report by the IAEA, or as President Bush used to call it, the IAEA, that suggests there is still some interest in Iran in pursuing nuclear weapons. Maybe you didn't hear this. From the Washington Post, Iran is experiencing surprising setbacks in its efforts to enrich uranium, according to new assessments that suggest that equipment failures and other difficulties could undermine that nation's nuclear plans. Former U.S. officials and independent nuclear experts say continued technical problems could also delay Iran's march towards possibly achieving nuclear weapons capability. Indications of Iran's diminished capacity, well, that would be their defense then, to enrich uranium are a drop in production at Iran's main nuclear enrichment plant, uranium enrichment plant near Natanz. A new assessment based on 3 years of internal data from UN nuclear inspection suggests that Iran's mechanical woes are deeper than previously known. Deep woes. At least through the end of 2009, the Natanz plant appears to have performed so poorly that sabotage, or as Bill Shatner pronounces it, sabotage, cannot be ruled out as an explanation. According to a study by David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security and a one-time U.S. WMD inspector. Not like a chicken inspector. The study showed that more than half of the Natanz plant's 8,700 uranium enriching centrifuges were idle at the end of last year, and the number had dropped of working machines steadily from 5,000 in May to just over 3,900 in November. Output from the nominally functioning machines was about half of what it was expected. And another analysis by the Federation of American Scientists describes Iran's flagging performance and suggests that continued failures may increase Iran's appetite for a deal with the West. They are really struggling to reproduce what is literally half-century-old European technology and doing a really bad job of it, says a spokesman for the Federation. These findings are in line with assessments by numerous foreign U.S. and European officials and weapons analysts who say Iran's centrifuges appear to be breaking down at a faster rate than expected, even after factoring in the notoriously unreliable 1970s vintage model the Iranians are using. According to several of the officials, the problems have prompted new thinking about the urgency of the Iranian nuclear threat, although not at cable news. And a personal note, ladies and gentlemen, this past Tuesday, I and everybody I knew and everybody I didn't know was experiencing quite a beautiful Mardi Gras day. And as it turned out, at the same time, a dear friend was ending her long and courageous struggle on Mardi Gras morning. So this one's for Mary. Hello, welcome to the show.
Friends are calling cause they're falling down. I've joined the circus, but I ain't no clown. There's five eaters and some midgets too. Around the corner, right next to the zoo. Call me crazy, and it's probably true. At least you call me now, here's a clue. What's black and white and red all over? A newspaper story about a murdered lover. I feel half crazy and I feel half-hearted. Down the well of wishes of the bearded departed. Come to find out we are all connected. Mosquitoes bit me and they got infected. Mardi Gras has come to town. Time to lay your burden down. I'm back in it Tuesday again. Get a midnight call, but to no avail. I got the boat, but I forgot the sail. I'll soon be rowing gently down the stream. Upon the sheets I will lie and dream. When I wake, the sun will shine like madness. Down on the heads of the drunken masses. Out on the streets with their glasses full. Riding in a buggy while the mule pulls. Drivers rewrite the course of history. While the local past remains in mystery. Europeans and people of color joining the party that is seeing double. Mardi Gras has come to town. Time to lay your burden down. Hop back in it Tuesday again. Tell me how fat can it Tuesday get? You're on the water with a fishing net. Boil it down and sit at the table.
autopsy showed you were full of fish. A broken heart and a come true wish. Now if fire burns out on the levee and the weight of the world is not that heavy, as when you were a little kid, now don't forget to pick up the lid. If you went on back, would you change a thing? Wait and see what tomorrow will bring. Mardi Gras has come to town. Time to lay your burden down. Hot bad in a Tuesday get. Boy, you ain't seen nothing.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, yes, there may be curling on your TV. That means it's Olympics time. Why else would there be curling on your TV? Unless you're in Canada or Scotland. The cancellation of 20,000 more tickets to events at Cypress Mountain is putting Vancouver Olympics organizers increasingly on the defensive, according to the Seattle Times, as they attempt to salvage the world's impression of the Games. In an hour-long briefing this week, touching on everything from transportation snafus to equipment failures to weather woes to the prison camp look of the Olympic cauldron display, some reporters demanded to know if this might be the worst start ever to an Olympic Games. Clearly concerned about the way these Olympics are being portrayed internationally, Vancouver Organizing Committee spokeswoman Renee Smith-Vallade said, "We've seen some press from Britain that we've looked at and wondered which city the reporter is reporting from. It doesn't feel like it's here." Mark Adams, spokesman for the International Olympic Committee, praised the Vancouver Committee's quick action to deal with problems and insisted that athletes and fans are still having, for the most part, a very positive experience. By far, of course, the biggest pall was cast even before the games opened with the death of the luge racer from Georgia, triggering controversy about the safety of the track and the fact that the Canadians had restricted access to the track for practice to all except Canadian athletes. That's the spirit. Who knew? Canada. I thought they were peacekeepers. And of course, opening night, one of the four huge pillars intended to light the cauldron at the Olympics opening ceremony failed to rise. The ice resurfacing equipment broke down 2 days in a row at the Olympic Oval, delaying speed skating events. A replacement is being brought from Calgary. The men's super combined in the mountains at Whistler was postponed because of an overnight snowstorm. That's just the latest weather delay. Earlier, several events and practices had to be rescheduled because of fog, snow, or rain, which screws up NBC's tape delay, I would think. If it's already delayed before it's happening live, why do you need the tape? Smith-Vallade said many of the difficulties have been caused by the warmest winter weather on record. No reason why that should be. But the problems at Cypress Mountain have only partly been due to weather. Buses have broken down or gotten lost on the way up, with fans waiting for hours in the cold and darkness to return to Vancouver. And spectators, barred from bringing their own food and drink, waiting for more than an hour just for a warm beverage. Vancouver officials said it would have been impossible to have additional customer facilities at the relatively small site, a response that fueled criticism of Cypress Mountain's selection as a venue. The additional ticket cancellations at that venue, now totaling 28,000 tickets, stemmed from the closure for all remaining events of the standing room area for snowboard and freestyle skiing. That area was built by packing tons of snow on top of bales of straw, but persistent rains have washed away much of the snow. The Vancouver committee will refund the purchase price of the tickets, $50 to $65 apiece, but only to the original buyer. Anyone who bought tickets at the secondary market is stuck. The Olympics. It's a movement. And we all need one every day. And there's more about the Olympics. This one about the next Olympics. The entire Olympic site in East London, that's for the 2012 Olympics, has been built on top of a thin plastic sheet laid at a depth of less than 3 feet to separate the surface soil from potentially heavily contaminated ground below. The British newspaper, The Sunday Express, has obtained documents which reveal that chiefs of the London Organizing Committee have covered up land that is possibly contaminated with asbestos and radioactive materials with this huge bright orange sheet. Buried at a depth of 31 inches to protect the health and safety of future builders and homeowners. It's designed as a warning marker layer to anyone digging the foundations of new homes and offices that they must follow special precautions if they need to excavate more deeply. These would be the homes and businesses that would be built after the Olympics are over. Clean soil and debris have been placed above the sheet. Anything below it has to be considered hazardous unless proved otherwise. These revelations cast doubt on the British government's central justification for staging the Games, that they would be handing over a huge urban park fit for human habitation and 10,000 new homes. Even after the Games have finished, the site will still be classified as brownfield, with the onus on future developers to find the money for extra decontamination work outside the Olympic budget. Yes, it is movement, and we do need one every single day. But it's brownfield. That doesn't mean it's blackfield, does it? And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. More about the new Iraq from the Observer newspaper in London. One of Iraq's two most prominent Sunni politicians has withdrawn his party from next month's general election and called on Sunni voters to boycott the polls, a move that has raised fears of a repeat of the country's disastrous 2005 election. Iraq's once dominant Sunni Muslims shunned the last election en masse, fueling a lethal insurgency that took 3 years to quell. It would be disastrous if they also refused to take part in this election, which is being billed as a critical test of Iraq's post-war recovery and the U.S. military's claim that its more than 100,000 soldiers in the country are no longer needed. The call for a boycott was made by Saleh al-Mutayak, leading the National Dialogue Front. Al-Mutayak was on a list of 500 individuals barred from standing in elections, running, we say, because of their connection to the old Ba'athist regime. Who helped create the list? Ahmed Chalabi. Isn't it cute how he always shows up in this? Part of the Accountability and Justice Commission. Al-Mutayak had lobbied unsuccessfully for the ban on him to be overturned. He says he has no current links to the Ba'ath Party, of which he was a member during the 1970s and early 1980s. His pleas for a review have been ignored by several regulatory bodies. There was no immediate response from other Sunni political parties to Al-Mutayak's call. It's Mutayak, not Mutayak. But if other Sunni groups do also withdraw, there are fears of a dangerous political vacuum after the election. Calling General Petraeus. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown says he supported his nation's involvement in the Iraq War as a result of Saddam Hussein's non-compliance with UN weapons inspectors and not because of fears of a WMD attack. That's according to the Scotsman newspaper. Brown said Hussein's defiance of UN resolutions that obligated him to allow full access to investigators searching for WMD provided the U.S. and U.K. with justification for the invasion. His remarks differ greatly from the justification provided by London in 2003 for participating in the invasion. British lawmakers asserted that the U.K. was involving itself primarily, quote, to ensure the disarmament of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, unquote. Of course, those didn't exist. Brown's interview suggests that when he appears before that independent panel investigating British involvement in the war in just 2 weeks, he might try to disassociate himself from now discredited assertions about pre-war Iraq. Among those assertions, those made by Colin Powell, a distinguished guest on today's Face the Nation, by the way. And by the way, you may recall, longtime listeners to this broadcast may remember, we actually reported at the time two other nations that had ignored a similar number of UN resolutions to Iraq at the time, as of 2003, Turkey and Israel. And finally, from the Sunday Times, on the face of it, the capture of Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, the Taliban's top strategist, as he came out of a madrasa in Karachi, seemed to be a coup. Jubilant American officials described it as a game changer. A tremendous achievement for Pakistani intelligence, crowed the U.S. Special Representative Richard Holbrooke. Unidentified officials quoted by the New York Times said Baradar was providing a wealth of information. This was the first time Pakistan had acted against the Taliban leadership. But Afghans involved in Western-backed attempts to start talks with the Taliban to end the war were furious, warning the arrest might have ruined chances of negotiations. It is a spectacular own goal for the U.S., says one official. That's soccer talk for we help the other team score. They want to wreck talks, said a close aide to Afghanistan's president, Hamid Karzai. Mullah Baradar was independently in contact with the Afghan government to find a way for reconciliation, and the Pakistanis knew that from their secret agents, unquote. Baradar had participated in meetings, including one in Saudi Arabia with Karzai's brother. Other Taliban leaders are skeptical about talks. The timing of this arrest was very peculiar, says a senior official for Afghanistan and Pakistan, AFPAC, at the U.S. Institute of Peace, a think tank. The fact that he was one of the key Taliban leaders advocating talks suggests the Pakistanis either want more control or to sabotage the talks altogether. The arrest came days after Pakistan publicly stated it needed a role in any negotiations. Pakistan has invested a lot in the Taliban, with whom it has worked for more than 20 years. Its military intelligence service, the ISI, helped them to take control of Afghanistan in the 1990s, and its generals, Pakistan's generals, ladies and gentlemen, refer to the Taliban as, quote, assets, unquote. Our friends, Pakistan. The ISI is arresting the Taliban leaders who are reconcilable, says Idris Khan, a human rights activist in Pakistan. By doing this, they want to save them from being killed by those Taliban who don't want to accept peace. After the arrest, U.S. officials said Pakistan should have a place at the negotiation tables, but some experts believe Pakistan's military has little interest in peace in Afghanistan because then they would no longer be needed by the U.S. and the dollars would dry up. They point out that the only previous senior Taliban figure to be arrested in Pakistan, Mullah Dadullah, not kidding, Mullah Dadullah, had also opened talks with Kabul. Islamabad's motive may be financial. Pakistan is bankrupt, and the U.S. had blocked $1.3 billion of aid because of a dispute over a refusal to grant visas to U.S. security officials. The first $349 million slice of that will be released in the coming week following the arrest of Baradar. One thing is clear, says the Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch. Pakistan can no longer claim the Taliban leadership is not in its country. The question is, if it can arrest Baradar, what about the others? News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Hey, ladies and gentlemen. I was on the campus of UC Berkeley on Friday interviewing a man you may remember from being interviewed on this broadcast, Dr. Bob Bee, who conducted one of the two independent forensic investigations of the flooding of New Orleans. I'm interviewing him for my upcoming documentary film, The Big Uneasy. But you know who else is on the Berkeley campus? This has nothing to do with Dr. Bee. But also ensconced on that campus is, of course, John Yoo, the chief author of the Bush administration's torture memo, who we learned this week told Justice Department investigators that the president's war-making authority was so broad, he has the constitutional power to order a village to be massacred. That's from the report released Friday by the Friday night, you know, when nobody will notice, by the Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility following a four-year investigation into the torture memos. The views of you, not your views, the views of you, were deemed to be so extreme and out of step with legal precedents they prompted the Internal Watchdog Office to conclude last year he committed intentional professional misconduct when he advised the CIA it could proceed with waterboarding and other aggressive interrogation techniques. The OPR report concluded that you and his boss at the time, Jay Bybee, now a federal judge, yes, sir, Your Honor, sorry, Your Honor, should be referred to their state bar associations for disciplinary proceedings. But another senior Justice Department lawyer, David Margolis, reviewed the report and has overruled its findings on the grounds that there was no clear and unambiguous standard by which the Office of Professional Responsibility was judging you and Bybee. Margolis said they were guilty of only, quote, poor judgment, unquote. You know, like. The report is filled with new details, though, into how a small group of lawyers at the Justice Department, the CIA, and the White House crafted the legal arguments that gave the green light to those interrogation tactics. The Bush administration officials were so worried about the prospect that CIA officers might be criminally prosecuted that Attorney General Ashcroft even suggested President Bush issue advance pardons for those engaging in waterboarding. Why would you need to do that? It's cool. It's fine. Everybody... The OPR investigator asked you, what about ordering a village of resistance to be massacred? Is that a power the president could legally... Yeah, you replied. Although let me say this, certainly that would fall within the commander-in-chief's power over tactical decisions. To order a village of civilians to be exterminated, the OPR investigator asked again. Sure, said you, the ex-terminator. You is depicted as the driving force behind the August 1, 2002 Justice Department memo that so narrowly defined torture, concluding that it didn't matter what the fine print of the law passed by Congress was. The president's authority superseded the law, and CIA officers who might later be accused of torture could argue they were acting in self-defense in order to save American lives. Said there was a section of the torture memo, well, he was writing news sections that included his controversial views on the president's powers as commander-in-chief, including the power to order a massacre of a civilian village, when one of his associates questioned the inclusion of that section and suggested it be removed. You replied, they want it in there. His associate said he didn't know who the they was, but assumed it was whoever it was that requested the opinion, the CIA and the White House. And the Justice Department investigators looking into the torture memos were told that emails sent by John Yoo, now he's a lawyer in the Justice Department, he knows what's legal and what's not, doesn't he? His emails had been deleted and couldn't be recovered. In a footnote to that report, The authors write that the Office of Legal Counsel initially provided us with a relatively small number of emails, files, and draft documents. After it became apparent that relevant documents were missing, we requested and were given direct access to the email and computer records of you, Bybee, and others. However, we were told that most of you's records had been deleted and were not recoverable. So, as I say, I was on the Berkeley campus. We had to stop filming at one point because of the noon Carillon concert. So this is my fervent request that an upcoming Carillon, and it's a live guy playing the Carillon, that an upcoming noon Carillon concert on the Berkeley campus, this song be played.
He just wrote and ran.
Who is you?
Torture memo man.
Who is you?
He went and banned the band.
Who is you?
Torture memo man. You got you some detainees. You don't know what to do. Them their Miranda rights or cover them with poo? Are you doing something illegal or proper through and through? There's only one guy to call, the one to ask is you.
But he's a bad mother.
Who is you?
He's in that secret clan. Torture memo man.
Who is you?
He had a clever plan.
Who is you?
Torture memo man. Oh, you've got some evildoers, and they will not say boo. A little pain and torment might change their point of view. But before you waterboard them, you wonder, could they sue? One guy has got the answer, the one to ax is you.
Shut your mouth, I'm talking about God.
Who is you?
He just wrote and ran.
Who is you?
Torture memo man. Went and banned the band.
Who is you?
Torture memo man. All these laws and treaties, you want something new. This war may last forever, you need to turn the screw. He's teaching law at Berkeley, he'll drop the other shoe. Bill of Rights expires. The one who knows is you.
Who is you?
Catch him if you can.
Who is you?
Torture memo man.
Who is you?
He just banned the band.
Memo man.
Yeah, that sounds good on Carillon. This is Le Show. And ladies and gentlemen, one more item from the news from outside the bubble file that there's only one of us here, neglected earlier. The railway underpass has been known as Tickle Cock Bridge to generations of courting couples in Castleford, West Yorkshire, England. But it proved a source of embarrassment for civic leaders before a regeneration scheme, which was being filmed as part of a television series. In an attempt to spare blushes, a council official suggested it was called Tittle Cot Bridge instead of Tickle Cock Bridge, and a plaque bearing the sanitized name was erected. You should pardon the expression. An over-50s group in the town, Castleford Area Voice for the Elderly, took exception to the rewriting of history and went into battle. It has now won its fight with the district council, installing a replacement plaque bearing the original name, Tickle Cock. The group's chairman, Margaret Shillitoe, said the old plaque was wrong. It had the wrong name on, and we were offended by it. It was important to keep the name rather than having a new one just because someone decided it sounded a bit better. Tickle Cock is how the bridge has been known for generations. We love the name. It has got character and history. We don't want a name there for posterity that is wrong. The name is thought to date back to the late 19th or early 20th century and to refer to a, quote, monkey run, unquote, where boys and girls do their courting. It's Britain. It's charming. Feelings over the renaming ran so high that a public meeting was organized and a large majority came out in favor of referring to the original name. A local author said, I feel we should never alter names, and Tickle Cock has a very clear message behind it. I was horrified at another example of the nanny state telling us something we don't want to do. A local councillor said, some people do call it Tickle Cock, and some don't. But residents have pressured us to put this plaque back top now, how they felt it should be, and we've done that. It's not a big deal. I think some people thought Tittle Cot sounded better, and it was written up as such. I bring that up, ladies and gentlemen, because renaming and reimaging seems to be a sudden current passion in the no longer new administration. There was a report earlier this week that Obama administration officials were concerned at the imaging going on of the president. The fact that he was always seen or too often seen in press photo opportunities with, quote, guys in suits, guys standing around in suits, obviously referring to leaders of Congress. So they want to get him out more often, at least once a week, to more normal U.S. backgrounds. Back to the kind of backgrounds, of course, he was ensconced in during the campaign. And the word also came out this week that the administration has decided to rename the war in Iraq. This announcement came out just before the aforementioned call for a boycott by the Sunnis of the election. But the new name is Operation New Dawn, designed to reflect the reduced role U.S. troops will play as troop levels fall, according to a memo from Defense Secretary Gates. Since the U.S. invaded, the war has been known as Operation Iraqi Freedom. The new name will take effect in September. Such name changes aren't necessarily unusual. The name of the 1991 Persian Gulf War changed as the mission changed from Operation Desert Shield to Operation Desert Storm, and finally to Operation Southern Watch and Operation Northern Watch. But this is Operation New Dawn. The renaming continues. How far will it go?
We okay for a few?
Sure, Rom. Close the door. I don't want Axelrod to hear this. Yep.
He's not in the hall, if that's what
you... Well, you never know. Okay. Now, about this reimaging project.
Mm-hmm. We still had you standing with guys in suits this week.
I know. Michelle said to me Thursday night, guys in suits, what's with that?
The effing guys in Congress want to stand with you at these announcements, and these effing douchebags insist on wearing suits. Believe me, I went at them heavy for sport coats. No dice.
Okay.
This week, I need to get out around real people.
Mm-hmm.
Shirt sleeves?
Mm. A little wintry for that, don't you think?
Shirt sleeves in Phoenix works any effing time.
Right. But does that help people to identify with me or be envious?
Well,
you know, is it the vacation in Hawaii thing all over again?
Yeah, that's on the agenda for later this week.
What is?
Next vacation.
Mm.
Michigan. That's for effing sure.
Michigan? Well, I guess there's lakes there.
There's effing beautiful crap up there. Mm. Then, renaming. Mm-hmm. The Iraq War went over, you know, pretty well.
Meaning nobody paid much attention.
Best we could effing hope for.
I suppose. Michelle hates it.
What is wrong with New Dawn?
She says it sounds like a detergent.
All due effing respect, Mr. President. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But I still think Axelrod hit it right on the head.
Warning in America, except in Iraq.
effing bingo. Mm. Now, I gotta go kick Senator Reed and his alleged nuts.
So. Yeah, there is one more thing, Ron. I'm thinking we should, you know, do one more kind of, renaming. Yeah. I read that when it was translated, it sounded even clunkier. Mm. No, not that. I'm thinking of renaming something, closer to home. What do you think of President Barry Obama?
Why in the effing world would you want to do that? After all the time we spent sanitizing Barack, not to mention disappearing the Hussein.
It's like Operation New Dawn. It's a new beginning, less formal, more approachable. Valerie says it tests well, especially with women. They think it makes me... I think the word she used was hotter.
But it's the mother of all effing flip-flops.
You know, maybe like Barry White. And maybe you're forgetting. I was Barry before I was Barack.
Well, that's just like John Kerry on effing steroids. And it's freaking backing down. You should be shoving President Barack Obama down their effing throats, not sugarcoating it.
It's a return to my roots. It's a return to normalcy. It's American values.
Sir, all due effing respect, your problem right now is that nobody in Congress fears you. They vote against you, you smile. They disembowel your legislation, you call for more bipartisanship. If you're going to rename yourself, you should consider President Hannibal effing Lecter Obama. People in Congress got to believe you're going to eat their livers for breakfast if they cross you.
No, see, I think they fear the Barack in me. They don't feel like they can make a deal with a Barack. Barry they can deal with. You know, good old Barry. He's the guy down at the
bar.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Listen, I know you got to run. Just think about it. It's, it's like Operation New Me.
I'll effing think about it. But I know I'll effing hate it.
And if I had a boat, I'd go out on the ocean. And if I had a pony, I'd ride him on my boat. And we could all together go out on the ocean, set me up on my pony, on my boat. Now if I were Roy Rogers, I'd sure enough be single. I couldn't bring myself to marry an old devil. Just be me and Trevor. We'll go riding through them movies. Then we buy a boat and on the sea we sail. And if I had a boat, I'd go out on the ocean. And if I had a pony, I'd ride him on my boat. And we could all together go out on the ocean, set me up on my pony, on my boat. Now the mystery masked man was smart. He got himself a Tonto, 'cause Tonto did the dirty work for free. But Tonto, he was smarter. And one day said Kemosabe, well, kiss my ass, I bought a boat, I'm going out to sea. And if I had a boat, I'd go out on the ocean. And if I had a pony, I'd ride him my boat. And we could all together go out on the ocean, set me up on my pony, on my boat. And if I were like lightning, I wouldn't need no sneakers. Well, I'd come and go whenever I would please. And I'd scare him by the shade tree and scare him by the light pole, but would not scare my pony on my boat out on the sea. And if I had a boat, I'd go out on the ocean. And if I had a pony, I'd ride him on my boat. And we could all together go out on the ocean, set me up on my pony, on my boat. Set me up on my pony, on my boat.
We had a little technical glitch there, and so I should point out that the ROM's suggested renaming of the Afghanistan war as Operation We're Not Bombing As Many Civilians Anymore. Now, ladies and gentlemen.
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, agents and officers of the Department of Homeland Security, you know, they're the ones that keep us safe, have reported that 289 of their handguns, shotguns, or automatic rifles have been lost or stolen between 2005 and 2008. Weapons were left in places ranging from fast food restaurant restrooms to bowling alleys and clothing stores, this according to the agency's inspector general. Most of the losses could have been prevented, the IG said. In one case, a border officer left a weapon in his idling vehicle at a convenience store. Both the weapon and the vehicle were stolen. That's good Homeland Security. In another case, a shotgun and semi-automatic rifle were stolen from an officer's closet at home. Other agents left firearms in truck beds. Hey, trucks gotta sleep. Or in vehicle bumpers, where weapons fell off as the officers drove away. The Department of Homeland Security, through its components, did not adequately safeguard and control the firearms, the IG said. Most losses occurred because officers did not properly secure the firearms. The report recommended that the department set tighter rules for storing, transferring, and taking inventory of weapons, and for reporting when they're lost. The Department of Homeland Security, ladies and gentlemen. Speaking of which, the Transportation Security Administration's internal controls for preventing the release of sensitive security information are deficient. They led to the improper posting of details about airport security screening operations of the Internet last year. That's also from the Homeland Security IG, Richard Skinner. TSA failed to properly redact a public contract solicitation containing sensitive information on standard operating procedures for screening passengers and bags. The solicitation was posted to the Internet in March and remained online until December. The sensitive information was finally removed after a TSA employee notified agency officials about the security breach. That's good security, TSA. Yes, sir, I'm not making any jokes. No, sir. No, I wouldn't do that. Yes, sir. No, I'm... You're right, sir. I'm sorry, sir. I'll go back in line, sir. You bet, sir. Federal regulators have failed to correct mounting and longstanding maintenance deficiencies at American Airlines, despite receiving detailed complaints about the carrier's problems. That from the U.S. Department of Transportation's Inspector General. He didn't identify any immediate flight safety risks, but concluded that American's operational reliability has decreased since 2004, and that that trend, quote, increases the risk of serious incidents. Incidents, not ac. While the Inspector General's report faulted American, which has been under closer federal scrutiny for nearly 2 years, it blamed the FAA for failing to inspect American's increased maintenance deferrals and what the Inspector General called American's, quote, history of noncompliance with required inspections. They're like a regular Saddam airline. Although various factors underlie each of American Airlines' maintenance-related events, a lack of adequate FAA oversight is a critical thread, the Inspector General wrote. The FAA responding said it already identified many of the same weaknesses, and it's working with American to, quote, elevate its maintenance practices. All right, then. I feel better. The Census Bureau wasted millions of dollars in preparation for its 2010 population count, including thousands of temporary employees who picked up $300 checks without performing work and others who overbilled for travel costs. Federal investigators at the Commerce Department's Inspector General Office cautioned that the excessive charges could multiply once the $15 billion headcount begins unless the agency imposes tighter spending controls. On a positive note, investigators backed the Census Bureau's decision to spend $133 million on its advertising campaign, saying it was appropriate to boost public awareness. The spending included a $2.5 million Super Bowl ad some Republicans had criticized as wasteful. You're off the hook, babe. News of Inspectors General, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, sir. The saga of Bernie Carrick has come, at least for the moment, to an end. He was hailed as a hero after the September 11th attacks on New York and Washington, nearly became chief of Homeland Security. He was sentenced this week to 4 years in federal prison, and the district judge went well beyond federal sentencing guidelines. He said the guidelines do not take into account, quote, the almost operatic proportions of this case, unquote. After 9/11, Carrick, said the judge, in many ways acted in the highest tradition of a public servant, but then the fact that Mr. Carrick would use that event for personal gain and aggrandizement is a dark place in the soul for me. Some of the crimes were committed while Carrick was the chief law enforcement officer for the, quote, biggest and grandest city this nation has. Well, he's a judge. What does he know? Carrick, protege of former Mayor Rudy Giuliani, pleaded guilty to 8 felonies, including tax fraud, lying to the White House while being vetted for the Homeland Security post. Carrick told the judge he'd become a better person. I know I must be punished, he said, appearing in court without his trademark mustache. He stared straight ahead, showing no emotion when the 4-year sentence was imposed. He read a statement apologizing to the nation and hoping that history would judge him for the 30 years of service I've given to the country and the city of New York. He's already been ordered to pay $188,000 in restitution and to pay past due taxes and penalties on 60 years of tax returns. He has not yet paid anything. What did Carrick do while he was still police chief? He let some organized crime-connected figures help finance repairs to his house. While he gained national attention for his role at the time of 9/11, he also used an apartment in New York City that was set aside for R&R for police department members who were, of course, exhausted during the days after 9/11. He used that apartment as a trysting place for his affair with former book publisher Judith Regan. When Rudy Giuliani left the mayor's office and Carrick left the police chief's office, Carrick went into Rudy Giuliani's business of security consulting. And he was, at Giuliani's recommendation, nominated by President Bush to be the first head of the Department of Homeland Security. He would have been the guy losing the weapons. But then there were irregularities in the employment records of his nanny. That was the reason given for the withdrawal of his nomination. In other words,
when New York needed correcting, Carrick was there. With a countenance just as grim as a cleric's stare. When his house, it needed fixing, there was no money. When the mobsters would mix in, Carrick was there.
Carrick was there.
When the city was on fire, Carrick was there. Taking time out only for a torrid affair. Just to make a good impression, he used a flat meant for decompression of the guys in his profession. Carrick was there.
Carrick was there.
Carrick was there.
Carrick was there.
Carrick was there. When Mayor Rudy had his passion, Carrick was there. When the time had come to cash in, needed policing, Carrick was there. Though some said it was a fleecing, could Carrick care? It was 3 long months of training, then the crap, it started raining. So without complaining, Carrick was out of there. When Homeland needed securing, Carrick was there. But his nanny records were found in disrepair. So Bernie took a powder before the questioning got louder. On the pages of the tabloids, Carrick was there. Was there. When it's years in federal prison, Carrick is there. Apologizing to all sans his usual flair. Oh, he was lying, but it was just cash. Now he's crying without his mustache. On the name plaque above the jail, Carrick ain't there.
Carrick is there.
Carrick is there.
Carrick is there.
Carrick is there. Carrick is there.
Yes, it's true. A New York jail was named for Bernie Carrick, and now it's not. Transit Gloria, Transit Department, or Police Department, I guess. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet on your computer at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available on a mighty 104 in Berlin. Berlin! Ich bin ein Radio Berliner. Available for your smartphone at stitcher.com. Available as a free download for members at audible.com/leshow, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it would be just like that Carillon concert at Berkeley happening, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Hawaii, and Chicago in exile desks. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of the music heard here on, always available at harryshearer.com. And the show is on Twitter, at LeTwits. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. What's that buzzing?